It's 10:06. Good morning. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Well, the federal budget is massive. We just spent an hour talking about it. I doubt if anyone knows where all of the money goes. And when it comes to health care, there are numerous federal programs that give money to the states and local communities where services are actually performed. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is one of the agencies that dole out federal dollars to the states. In this case, the CDC provides funding to states according to its mandates in the areas of public health and disease prevention. This morning, we're going to talk with an expert who will, I hope, make it clear to us how those dollars are distributed and why. I'm sure you'll have questions and comments, so here are your phone numbers. 800-486-8655, toll free. 800-486-8655. And again, that's a toll free number. In Milwaukee, please use 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And I'll tell you right now, if you want to get in on this, please start calling, and we'll take calls as soon as we have people online. My guest this hour is Richard Hamburg, Director of Government Relations at the Trust for America's Health, an organization which just completed a study of how the CDC distributes its funds. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
First of all, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has these dollars appropriated by Congress, and then they distribute them to the states. What are these public health dollars supposed to be used for?
Well, the CDC, which is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has a series of state-level programs that they fund across a pretty wide variety of programs, many of them addressing chronic diseases like cancer and asthma and heart disease. Funds go out for emergency preparedness, for immunization programs, so all across the spectrum of public health. And much of the dollars go out in the form of cooperative agreements between the states and the federal government.
What do you mean by that?
You know, they're agreements where the dollars are made available, and states, have a list of goals and objectives that they need to meet. So, sort of dollars are provided, but they're provided for specific uses.
They aren't. In other words, they're not unrestricted funds. We just don't say, well, we have some goals here, but you take the money and do things how you think best.
Right. Well, there's certainly a lot of flexibility state by state, and it depends on what the particular programs are. And oftentimes the funds are used, let's take nutrition, physical activity. There are seven states that receive basic implementation grants, so grants, somewhat over $1 million, $1.3 million. And there are 21 states with planning grants, somewhere on the level of $350,000 a year to help put together plans to implement programs. So, there are specific things that those programs need to do, but, there is the flexibility where some might address nutrition issues, some are school-based, some are workplace. So, I think the CDC looks at states as, laboratories for testing out these different programs and then hopefully keeping track of best practices and sharing that with other states. So there's certainly deliverables that need to be met, but there's different levels of flexibilities for different programs.
As far as a pool of money is concerned, how big is the pot that the CDC is dividing up between the states?
Well, the total budget for the CDC is, or for discretionary health programs, is in the $6 billion area. And, overall, the approximately 80% of CDC funds are distributed to state and local health agencies through these grants or cooperative agreements. We're talking about large amounts of money going out to the states. However, the prevention dollars pale in comparison to the health care costs. And, we're basically still just throwing pennies at prevention, and the end result has been far greater figures for overall healthcare costs. So one theme for Trust for America's Health, other public health groups, and the CDC is to provide more resources to you know, address the problems before they happen for primary and secondary prevention. And down the road, you know, we'll see savings in dollars and lives and in quality of life. And certainly, clearly, prior interventions in nutrition, physical activity, tobacco control have shown that that we certainly can make progress.
So let's talk about the study that you just did of where these public health dollars are going. Why did you decide to do the study, and what did you find out?
Well, one of the reasons for doing this each year, and we put out a series of reports on an annual basis, and this is one we've done for several years now, and what we're trying to show are a few things. One, that every American should have the opportunity to be as healthy as he or she can be. And that there certainly is a role for the federal government to provide some money, some seed money, for these important prevention preparedness programs. What we see is that there's not necessarily the direct correlation that one would assume between burden of disease and funds. So, you know, let's look at Michigan, for example. As far as overall CDC funds, Michigan, I think, ranks 37th. Or 38th per capita, and 38th. So it's $18 per capita. The high is Alaska at almost 70. The low is Kansas at $13.61. So there's a wide range here. But looking at some burden of disease numbers, you know, where a lot of the CDC dollars go, let's look at level of obesity. Michigan was ranked 9th. Probably the highest northeastern or, you know, Midwest / northeastern state of all 50. Diabetes ranking is 11th, and hypertension 13th. So, you know, just an example there. You know, we have programs that address diabetes and heart disease and nutrition and physical activity. However, you know, you find that Michigan is, you know, well below the curve, and although just somewhat over the average, certainly well below the median at 38th. You know, same thing for emergency preparedness. Is, you know, there's always a debate going on as to the distribution of funds and whether funds should be distributed where there's a higher risk of a terrorist attack or that sort of thing. So, you know, just what we're trying to point out here is the importance of public health programs to show that there are disparities between states and between regions. And then we also look at state-specific dollars. We look at how much individual states are investing. And on that list, just looking at four states in your area there, of the 50 states, Illinois comes in 33rd, Michigan 36th, Minnesota 44th, and Wisconsin 50th out of the 50 states in the District of Columbia in per capita state public health expenditures. So, you know, all these states seem to be below the curve, both in the dollars the federal government is providing and even the dollars that the states are providing.
The one would expect that there would that they wouldn't just say, okay, we have $6 billion, so we divide that by 50, and here's your grant. That there would be some differences, even just based on things like, okay, if you have a huge population, your per capita number might be smaller, but your total amount might be larger than, say, a state with a smaller population. But I'm thinking that there's probably more to it than this.
Well, a lot of these programs are competitive, so you do have states applying for additional dollars. You know, there's always a political nature to it when you have a limited number of grants. And you know, what you find is that there are a lot of funded, or I should say, approved but unfunded programs. So if there were additional dollars for almost every chronic disease program, there are states out there that are, you know, are looking for additional dollars. So, you know, just like any process, I think it's a combination of burden of disease. It's a combination of political. You know, we were talking about federally appropriated dollars here, and you know, I think that you know, the clear message is, you know, there are not enough funds. You know, we need to spend more to prevent. And when I mean prevent, it's not just disease, but it's public health emergencies. We need to make sure that, you know, with the threat of a pandemic flu on the horizon, that, you know, across the board, states are as prepared as they can, because when you're talking about a pandemic, when you talk about immunization programs, those have to be 50-state programs. No one blinks. In fact, if there were a childhood vaccine available, the federal government and the states would make it available to all 50 states. I mean, you couldn't say, hey, I'm giving it to these 15 states, but not those 35. But for some reason, chronic disease programs, we do have a track record of funds being made available to certain states and not others. That's a little different situation, but still, the point we're trying to make is that there's a high burden of disease in every state. So even if you look at Colorado and you say that's got the lowest level of obesity and overweight, still more than 50% of that population is overweight, and I believe 17% are obese. So so even the states that are in better shape have a lot of work to be done.
So why should we care that Kansas got $13.61 ahead from the CDC program, and Alaska got nearly 70? Why should it make a difference to us that there's that big a disparity?
Well, there are differences in levels of preparedness that are needed. There are differences in the burden of disease, state by state, disease by disease. So, it makes sense that there are some disparities in funding, but, to look at a state budget like Hawaii, where they're spending $152 per capita, and knowing there are states that are spending single digits, Wisconsin, $9 per capita. That's a pretty large disparity. And, in some cases, states are supplanting dollars that weren't available from the federal government. So if there's more federal money, there may be less state money, and vice versa. But overall, we're far from meeting the needs of the public health community. And, it just doesn't seem to make sense that you have disparities like that. Now, what our report found is on a regional basis, for whatever reason, Midwest states received approximately $16 per person, with Western states close to 20, Northeastern 23, and Southern states close to 30. Now, there at least that makes a little more sense looking at the Southern states, that generally, that's the stroke belt. That's where you have higher levels of obesity, higher levels of diabetes, physical inactivity, higher poverty levels in many cases. So, that somewhat makes sense, but not to the extent that we're seeing here. And when we have even the healthiest state, in quotation marks, with more than 50% of the population overweight, we're far from being where we need to be. And although in certain interventions like tobacco control efforts have substantially decreased levels of tobacco use, and down the line, we've seen lung cancer rates beginning to go down. It's like a 25-year, there's a long time before the cancer kicks in, so it's going to be a long time before you see the benefits of it. But if you look at obesity rates, it's going up dramatically. At best, maybe the rate of increase may be finally slowing a little. But at worst, we now have, depending on what measurement you're using, several states that have over 30% obesity rates. I mean, that just is unacceptable, I think, to anyone.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll see if some callers want to join in on this discussion. I think the bigger question here that you raise is how much are we really spending all across the United States? And your contention would be that it's not enough, and we'll talk about that as well. Wisconsin ranks 45th among the states in receiving these public health funds from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So, dear listener, does that matter to you? Do you think that we should be getting more? Do you think that's about right? Maybe we're just so darn healthy here in Wisconsin, we don't need that money. Who knows? Well, you tell us, and here's how you do it. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you, so we'd appreciate it if you'd call 227-2050, 414-227-2050. We're talking about public health today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 22 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. After 1 on Talk of the Nation, Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe's hero or tyrant? That is the issue after 1 o'clock on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about public health. A recent study just came out and talked about what the states are receiving from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for public health issues. We've heard from our guests what this money is used for by the states and pretty much how it's divided up. Now we need to hear from you on what you think ought to happen. Do you feel that we're spending enough on public health issues? Do we need to spend more money on prevention and that will save us some money down the road? Does this make sense? Or do you just like things the way they are? Give us a call and let us know what you think. Maybe you have some questions about programs that have been run and how they're run. We'll try to answer those as well. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please use our local number. It's 227-2050, 227-2050. And helping us to sort through these issues this hour is Richard Hamburg. He's Director of Government Relations at the Trust for America's Health. So, Wisconsin, as I said, is 45th on the list of states in terms of capturing public health money from the CDC. Why should the citizens of Wisconsin, or why not, why should they be upset about this, or maybe it's not that big a deal?
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think the problem here is that every state is receiving a level of funding that's below where they should be. So, if you have a state or a series of states or a region that are, well below the curve, then, it's even exacerbated further. Looking at just the CDC budget, again, that's close to $6 billion. And one of the things that has troubled us, Trust for America's Health, over the past couple of years is that rather than increasing funding for the Centers for Disease Control, in particular in the area of prevention and chronic diseases, has been at best level and has actually been declining in recent years. And this year's budget, President's budget, recommends a $28 million decrease in prevention funding. So that's just counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense that at a time where, we only see pennies invested in prevention. Overall, there's a national healthcare expenditures number that the highest amount of money that's been spent on preparedness and prevention, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, peaked at about 3%, and now that figure is closer to 1.5%. So again, only pennies of the overall healthcare costs are on trying to prevent disease and to prevent emergencies, and that just to us it doesn't make sense.
We've got a call from Ron in Madison who wants to join us. Ron, good morning, and thanks for calling.
I was born in Kansas and live in Wisconsin now, so it's interesting that they're way down at the bottom of the barrel. The more important question than $13 versus $70 is, where does our federal tax money go? What have the federal politicians wasted it on that there's none left, or only $13 ahead left, to take care of human beings? Some things in the news you've probably heard about. $30 billion that the Fed gave so Bear Stearns could be bought up by some other big bank. That would have been $100 per capita for every human in all the 50 states. But the other big bank decided they would guarantee the first $1 billion of losses that the Fed took over in bad debts. So now we're only on the hook for $97 instead of $100. So that's more money per person than even Alaskans got for health care from the federal government. The other big number that you've heard recently is $3 trillion for the war. I don't know if it's just Iraq or if that includes Afghanistan also, but when you divide 300 million humans, that comes out to $10,000 per human in the U.S. that the Congress and the president have spent. And that explains very much why there's only $13 or $69 left over to take care of human beings on this continent. It's because we're wasting horrendous amounts of cash to kill people on other continents.
Thanks for the call, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, too little is being spent on public health. Too much is being spent for other things and for caring for individuals after they become sick rather than trying to prevent disease. So, you know, point is well taken just in general that this is such a small piece of the pie and, you know, we need more resources devoted to the public's health.
What do you think is the would be the real payback? Let's say that we did increase the amount of money going to the states in these programs that we've been talking about. And what could we expect to see on the other end in terms of the reduction of expenditures because people were healthier?
Well, clearly the health community has not done as good a job as it could. And has not had the information that it should have to make the case or do a better job of making the case that if you don't make the investment now, not only are you going to have less healthy individuals and more lives lost, you're going to have greater expenditures down the road. And what we're actually looking at Trust for America's Health is in the process of working with a number of organizations to develop a model that will actually show the return on investment dollars for community-based interventions will lead to. So, for example, if you put in additional physical activity in schools and better nutrition, more walkable communities, expand immunization programs, those sorts of things that down the road we want to be able to show savings in Medicare and Medicaid, out-of-pocket expenses, private health insurance. So I think we're able to do that now. Where we're not able to show that earlier, and unfortunately, the way the federal budget works, the Congressional Budget Office, in technical parlance, scores these interventions. That's the word that they use, and the way that they score, the way they figure out how much a program costs, doesn't necessarily take into account the savings down the line. So when you're talking prevention, the savings is always down the line. So we have to do a better job of showing the savings and having the individuals who look at this sort of thing take that into account when they're figuring out where to put the limited dollars.
Well, when I look at my the bill I get from my health care provider or the statement that I get from the insurance company about what they paid and what my responsibility is and so forth, it seems to me every time I walk into my doctor's office, regardless of the reason, it's $200 or $300. And so if I reduced my visits to the doctor per year to one to get my annual physical and didn't have to see him the rest of the year or compared that with, say, maybe I might go and see him five or six times if I wasn't very healthy, it shouldn't be too hard to put in a multiplier there and say, okay, $200 versus $1,200 is, we saved $1,000 just with that one person. It surprises me that no one has come up with this model yet to be able to say, look, if you don't have to access medical services or health services, every time you access them, it should be an average of so much money. And if you don't, well, we just saved that on the other end. I guess I'm kind of surprised we haven't seen that.
Yeah, well, I think it's coming, and it's been too long in waiting for this, and it seems to make sense. You know, if knowing the incredible costs from tobacco use, if less people smoke down the line, people live longer lives and healthier lives. And, slowly but surely, we're seeing co-payments for preventive services and preventive visits dropped. Medicare didn't even have a so-called welcome to Medicare visit, a preventive visit, when you hit 65. That wasn't even in place until a few years ago, and certainly not enough people even utilized that service. Cholesterol screenings, cardiovascular screenings under Medicare, 5 years ago wasn't covered unless you had you already had heart disease. And that doesn't make sense. You cover it when you have the heart disease. You don't cover it before you have the heart disease. So I think slowly we're making strides in this area. And I think a combination of moving in that direction and doing a better job of making the case, you know, it's like the old commercial for pay me now or pay me later, putting that gasoline additive in your car. It's really no different here. But here we're talking about people and people's lives, and you need to invest in prevention. And then down the line, you'll invest less in health care, and in theory, you'll be able to utilize those funds for a lot more productive uses.
Pay me now or pay me later was the slogan for the Fram oil filter people. We spent the hour before you joined us. We talked about how whoever is coming in as the next president and whoever is in the next Congress is going to have to raise our taxes because we've already overspent ourselves to the point of virtual bankruptcy. And so there's going to be, for whatever resources are left over, and particularly as the baby boomers continue to age and the cost of the entitlement programs increases, we're going to be looking at the scraps of that are left of the discretionary portion of the federal budget being even more viciously fought over than they are now. How can we best make the case to our members of Congress, our senators, and our representatives that we want to see them spend more money on prevention so that we'll be able to save this money down the road? If we can keep our senior citizens healthier so that they don't have to go to the doctor as often and don't require as many prescriptions, if we can keep our young people healthier to begin with so that they don't get sick when they get older, how do we make that case effectively at the federal level, which seems to be where we need to make it?
Well, it appears that, for example, in the national presidential debate, that healthcare is becoming more and more of a focus. So what individuals need to do is communicate to those candidates, communicate to their members of Congress, to their state legislatures, to their governors, that that we need to ensure that that prevention and preparedness is part of that healthcare debate, that preventing and combating threats to our health is the primary responsibility of the nation's public health system. So, you know, we have some guiding principles that we've been communicating over the past couple of months. One is that that we believe that prevention must drive the nation's health strategy. Okay, we believe that Americans deserve healthy and safe places to live, work, and play. On the preparedness side, we believe that every community should be prepared to meet the threats of infectious diseases, terrorism, and national disasters. And the last piece is that Americans deserve to know what government is doing to keep them healthy. So by putting out our Shortchanging America's Health Report, we're just trying to shine a little brighter light on where dollars are being spent so that people have more money and they have some tools to say, hey, why are you spending the money here, not there?
Well, I've read that the United States, pretty much among developed nations, the United States spends more on health care than pretty much anybody. So what are we spending it on?
Well, the figure is the figure I'm looking at here is that this country spends more than $2 trillion with a T annually on health care, more than any other nation in the world. There's lots of priorities for expenditures from government at state, federal, and local levels, but the idea that we're spending trillions on health care, you know, and spending barely, and it's hard to use the word barely, but, you know, millions or billions as opposed to trillions, that's an inherent problem. And clearly that if we spend money a little more wisely, we put them into programs and that are successful. So, you know, we need accountability. So we're not just saying that we need to throw money at these problems. We need to find out which programs work. We need to have some transparency so that the voters, that the population know, you know, what works and what doesn't work. We should advocate for those programs. And so that's important. You know, you need to spend the money, but you need to make sure that you're spending it on programs that are effective.
Let's take a call next from John in Milwaukee. John, you're up next. Good morning. Thanks
for
calling.
Two organizations that really tick me off that are really preventing any sort of progress. the Republican Party and the AME. The AME has been this force of conservative medicine for as long as we've known that refuses to adapt to a system. So here's my proposal. So simple and so sensical that it wouldn't be adopted. Take the deductible and flip it on its head and say the government will guarantee the first $500 of our medical care. Think of what the ramifications for preventive medicine would be. $500 is $100 billion. Let's say 200 million Americans. Take that as a proposal. 100 million, just like in Germany, say, we've got private. We'll take our own. That's how much? That's $100 billion. That is less than the cost of 1 year of war in Iraq. What do you think about that? Thanks.
Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. I'm not quite sure I understood everything that John was talking about there, but it's clear that that he's not happy with the way healthcare is operated in this country.
Yeah, the system needs to change, and it's everyone's responsibility. So, you know, I think the federal government is understanding that there's a private responsibility, there's a personal responsibility, there's family responsibility, but what we find is that there are barriers. We need to remove these barriers, and oftentimes governmental role is removing barriers to care. So, you know, just to get off the funding issue for a moment, you know, we can't tell people to be more active, or let's put it this way, we are telling people to be more active, to eat better, and then we can't send our kids to school and find out that they no longer have physical activity options, that physical education classes are limited, that vending machines have been put in with, you know, high fructose syrup, sodas, you know, fatty foods. You know, we need to remove these barriers. We need to make it easier. It's hard to tell someone to walk to school when there are no sidewalks. 20, 30 years ago, I don't know, the number is something along the lines of 75-80% of kids walk to school. Now that figure is about 1/4 of that. So there are all these barriers. We have areas in large cities, certainly a number of them in the Midwest, that are food deserts in low-income areas where what we mean by food desert is the food isn't available. There are areas where there aren't even supermarkets, where the only places where people can buy foods are in small stores that don't carry fruits and vegetables. So we need to remove barriers. We need to make it easier for people to live healthier lives.
We're going to take a call next from Geraldine in Madison. Geraldine, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, and thank you for the program. I have a suggestion, and I'm sure there are limitations to how these funds can be used, but what would be the possibility of taking a state and ensuring, take a state and have a program, say maybe a 5-year program or 6-year program, and making sure that all of the residents are insured with some type of health care? Now, certainly in Wisconsin, we do have MediCare. We have a type of system where all children are insured, and women who and things of that situation, certain families. But make sure all residents are insured. Would that not help with the health care system?
I think anything that can be done to ensure access to health care for all is going to help the situation. I mean, that's a broader issue than we've been talking about here this morning. But you know, clearly, the insurance system and different aspects of it, including whether or not individuals are insured at all, is a major barrier to the public's health.
Geraldine, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Anna in Twin Lakes. Anna, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you. You know, I was a surgical tech for a while, and we had a gentleman who came in who had lost a lot of weight, 200 pounds on his own, and needed a full body lift. But because he lost it on his own, the insurance wasn't going to cover it. But if he had had a geriatric surgery, which is $15,000, $20,000, plus a very high risk of infection and complications, if he had done that, then the insurance would have covered that kind of the full body lift. And I just think it's absolutely absurd that the insurance companies are kind of working backwards here. You know, they're not letting you do things on your own. But if you go get surgical intervention for it, then that's okay. I don't understand. I would think that there would be more money, you know, they would save more money and it would be better for everyone involved if they were to actually allow people to go work, you know, do things on their own without having to have the surgical intervention and cover more things when people were more willing to work on their own or able to do things on their own than have surgical interventions. I just don't understand that type of mentality with the way the insurance and the medical field works.
Point well taken. I mean, you've identified yet another barrier. I mean, there are a lot of barriers out there, and not everything in the system as it's currently situated makes sense.
Anna, thanks for that call. Well, when we talk about the insurance system and how healthcare is paid for in this country, what do you? What's your organization's position, for example, on removing the profit motive from insurance? In other words, having the government be the single payer for universal healthcare. That's certainly one proposal that's been out there. Removing the profit motive and passing those and using those savings perhaps to make us all healthier, or would it in fact save money? There's a lot of debate out there about that, but. Anna's question kind of made me think about that particular aspect of it.
Well, you know, our position is that clearly, you know, we have 47 million Americans who are uninsured. We're spending these, you know, $2 trillion a year, and that, you know, all Americans should have access to affordable, quality health care. And, you know, the financial incentives need to be made in the areas of wellness and disease prevention. And, you know, that's where the incentive should be. And, you know, there are a lot of good ideas out there in the, you know, sometimes we focus on the insurance community, but on the business community, you know, there are a lot of companies. Safeway is one of them. Blue Cross Blue Shield from the insurance side that are beginning to understand that that companies need to be more economically competitive, that by saving dollars on healthcare, they're going to be more competitive. You know, there are a lot of stories about companies now going into areas and asking those questions before they put a new plant or a new company, wondering what the level of healthcare costs are, levels of obesity, levels of diabetes, et cetera. And, you know, that's a factor in decisions being made. But it's, you know, overall, you know, there's a role for the insurance companies. There's a role for individuals, there's a role for government, and there's a role for industry. And, you know, we need wellness programs, we need whatever the incentives are, won't go into the details, but, you know, we need incentives for promoting sound health.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have some more people who want to join us by phone, and we'll get to those calls in just a moment. We're talking about health care, and we've kind of gotten off the original topic, which was the fact that Wisconsin is 45th among the states in capturing dollars from the CDC's public health programs. But this has kind of morphed into a general discussion of health care, and that's just fine with me because people are participating and we're getting some valuable information. The genesis of the program was a study that was done that demonstrates how the money is distributed that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention get. But the real point is that the total number of dollars being appropriated for that purpose is too small. Regardless of what state gets how much money, the total dollar, the pot itself, needs to be enlarged. We'll continue to talk about that topic and take your phone calls right after we come back. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:47. Coming up next hour, where can you find the best burger in Wisconsin and in the nation? Larry Mueller finds out after 11 from Doug Moe, columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal, and George Motz of New York, author of the new book, Hamburger America. Well, I know which place would get my vote, but I won't mention it on the air. You'll have to ask me privately to get that. Anyway, you can talk about that next hour. Perhaps we all ate fewer hamburgers, we could spend less on health care, but I don't want to get into that debate. Somebody's likely to file a lawsuit against me or something. Anyway, this hour we're talking about how federal health care dollars dedicated to preventive programs are distributed across the United States with Richard Hamburg, Director of Government Relations at the Trust for America's Health. Mr. Hamburg, just before we went to a break, we were talking about about various economic incentives and so forth, and how businesses are seeing that in order to be more competitive, they have to get some kind of handle on healthcare costs. My understanding is that I believe it was Toyota made a decision to put their a factory in Canada rather than in the United States because healthcare costs were so much cheaper. And I've also read that General Motors, for example, one of their biggest individual costs is healthcare for their workers, and that it both drives up the cost of their automobiles and trucks and reduces their profit margin as well. So this has become more than just an issue for insurance companies and for people seeking health care. There's a real business component to this, and in order to stay competitive in the world, we're going to have to address this issue fairly quickly.
Oh, absolutely. And more and more companies are focusing on wellness and health care costs. They are either using health care costs as, it's certainly a factor in deciding whether to move a company or establish a company in a particular area. So, they're getting hit by the same costs everybody else is. Now, on the positive side, there are companies that are putting dollars into wellness and are understanding what the benefits will be down the line. Motorola, for example, they have a wellness program that they have found saves the company nearly $4 for every $1 invested in wellness benefits. MetLife has told us that they estimate a 2.5 to 1 return on investment from its fitness program. So it costs about $550,000 a year, and they saved in healthcare costs. Their estimate was close to $1.4 million, and on and on and on. So it definitely is a cost of doing business, and there is a clear relationship between health and U.S. economic competitiveness, both on an individual basis, individual companies, and for the economy as a whole.
Susan in Milwaukee wants to join our discussion. Susan, good morning and welcome.
Thank you. The conversation earlier about the public schools and their efforts toward the health of our children really piqued my interest. I have had an ongoing issue with the hot lunch menu at my kids' school. And one thing I noticed that I wanted to ask your expert was there is so much pork on the menu. And first of all, there's religious considerations with a large segment of our population in the public schools. Secondly, my kids never eat it. And thirdly, I don't think of it as a very healthful meat. I would like them to have more grains and more fruits and vegetables, but that doesn't seem to happen. We'll see a brat on the menu, or also have this thing called a mock chicken leg, which is really a pork cutlet that's breaded and fried. And my question is this because of a relationship between the Department of Education and the pork lobby? I mean, I talked to our principal, and he says that he can't do anything about it. It would just be so nice if somebody would just, take the interests of the kids' long-term health into consideration in making these dietary recommendations.
Well, we'll come at this from a couple of different angles. One is that there are nutritional standards set by the federal government through the USDA for schools. So this is two-pronged. One, public health groups are working with the federal government to ensure that the next set of recommendations are higher nutritional standards than the current ones. Now, individual states, and then I would think school districts in turn, can, if they want, go for nutritional standards that exceed the USDA standards. And in a report, F as in Fat, that we put out last August, we found that 17 states, Wisconsin not one of them, had put in place nutritional standards that exceed the USDA. The other area to worry about in the schools is so-called competitive foods. Those are foods sold outside the school lunch, school breakfast program. So we're talking about everything from stadium concessions to school stores, those sorts of things, and vending machines. And again, certain states, close to half the states, have either established nutritional standards for those foods and or limited access to those foods in vending machines. And we're not just saying necessarily taking out the less healthful foods from vending machines, although particularly at the elementary level, that's something that should be considered, but we're talking about choices, having healthier choices out there. So, you know, there's definitely differences, and there's cultural differences from state to state and the types of foods, but overall the goal is certainly on a national basis, state by state, to ensure a higher level of nutritional standards. They're far lower than they should be. Progress is being made, but nowhere near where we need to be.
Susan, I was wondering if you had approached any member of your school board to ask about the content of the school lunches. I wouldn't think that principals would have much to do or much to say about hot lunch, but I would imagine that a member of the school board might have some influence there.
And we have, and you know, we've basically gotten around the problem when, you know, the kids get the month ahead, and they bring a cold lunch on the days when they don't like things. But I just was amazed at the quality of the food that they're getting, and we certainly, you know, do our best to incorporate like 9 fruits and vegetables a day in our kids' diet. But when you think about the health effects of a poor diet and how much junk food is eaten in the urban environment in general, the last thing you want to do is at the one place where the government can have an access point with these kids to, you know, be furthering these negative habits.
Let's go next to Roger in Fitchburg and try and get a couple more calls in here. Roger, good morning. Thank you for calling.
Yes, the guest said that there is a role for insurance companies. Well, we already have 1,500 insurance companies, 800 of whom operate in Wisconsin. They pay only 19% of non-governmental health costs. I think what we need is what the 36 countries that the World Health Organization says has better health care than the United States, and that is single-payer health insurance without private interests involved or very heavily regulated government programs as they have in those 36 countries. Private insurance companies are the problem. The profit-making in the insurance is the reason why we're in the situation we're in, I think. So shame on you, guest, for talking around that. I think you know that what we've got to do is get rid of private interests in insurance, health insurance underwriting.
Well, you know, I think that the goal is quality, affordable health care for everyone, you know, however it's done. And there's a lot of different ways to do this. So, you know, that's our goal is access to the right care, more money in prevention, and, you know, and that's at all levels.
Let's go next to a call from Mark in Genesee. Mark, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. The guest commented about the USDA standards, and we all know that's a sham. I am a healthcare provider in inner city Milwaukee, working in a family practice clinic, and USDA standards on health, that food pyramid that we are also familiar with, is really the biggest sham that the government could have perpetrated on its citizenry. It really supports the food industry that is out to make money, not to promote health. The main reason for my call was to comment about how everything that you have been suggesting is a Band-Aid. We have so many people who are obese, who have hypertension, diabetes, asthma, you name it. And every little approach that has been suggested is a Band-Aid for this and a Band-Aid for that. And we really need something a lot more comprehensive to deal with the whole issue of our unhealthy lifestyle of eating poor food, not exercising properly, all of which is supporting an overall sense of not being healthy on multiple areas.
Mark, thanks for the call. I need to jump in here because we're almost out of time, and I want to have our guests have a chance to respond. Mr. Hamburg, you've got about 40 seconds.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, it's societal change is needed, and you know, I don't want to overstate the role of government in this, but you know, we come at this at an angle trying to remove barriers here, promoting, you know, major societal change to put more resources into prevention and to save down the line. So, absolutely, you know, we don't think it's a Band-Aid approach, and you know, this particular report does happen to focus on government resources, and the general theme is There's not necessarily as much rhyme or reason as there should be about where the dollars are going, but also a general theme that, there's not enough going into prevention, not enough going into programs that, can save lives down the line. So it's, you know, it's certainly a commitment is needed at absolutely all levels of society.
Thank you so much for spending this time with us. It's been extremely informative.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Richard Hamburger is Director of Government Relations at the Trust for America's Health. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. John Treader handled on-air production, and I am very appreciative to both of them. If you'd like a copy of the program, call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program 43E, as in excellent. Stay tuned. Larry Mueller is coming up after the news. Tell us about the best hamburger in Wisconsin. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.